They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, joining me on the podcast this week, he is one of the best writers we have at Sports Illustrated. He's the author of this year's Sportsman of the Year story, and he is the best damn wing uncle you could ever ask for. Chris Ballard, senior writer.
Oh, wow. That's an intro. Thank you. Thank you, Mannix. I think it's Sports Person of the Year.
Sports Person?
Sports Person of the Year.
Now, what do we change the title since it's a team? You know, exactly. As you're listening to this, it is the Golden State Warriors as the sports people?
Person.
Person.
We suck singular, which is an interesting choice editorially.
These are the kind of things we should probably work out before we start the podcast.
Recording. Sure. Yeah.
Sports people. Okay. Or a sports person. We'll go with that. We'll go with sports person on that one. You wrote the story there. And before we get into some of the nitty-gritty of just for people that don't understand how a story like this works, it's arguably the biggest story that SI does every single year. Maybe inarguably that it's the biggest story they do every single year. How do you as a writer get involved with it? And what's your kind of early process?
There's a team of editors that makes this decision, as you know, and they will consider a lot of options and at a certain point reach out to one of the writers, often done in a sort of keep it between us level. What do you think of this? Do you think we could turn this into a story as well as an honor? And with the Warriors, it's interesting because it's a team designation. And we've done that a few times before at Sports Illustrated. We gave it to the women's soccer team. We gave it to the Red Sox when they broke the drought. We gave it to the U.S. hockey team. So there's some precedent for it, but it makes it a different kind of story. You're not honoring one person, but it has to be inclusive of, in this case, an organization. Mm-hmm. And I think in this case, it was also, you know, almost like when someone wins an Oscar after 15 nominations. In this case, the Warriors had been in the running before, and it was the sustained excellence. It wasn't a one-year thing. Often we honor someone who has an amazing year. In this case, we honored someone or an organization that had a remarkable four-year run.
Do you have to, when you get this type of assignment, do you have to like wipe everything else off your plate? Because it's a big assignment. I mean, it's a big story.
Yeah, in this case, for the most part, you can still work on other stories, but the way the Warriors are right now, there's so many interested media outlets in everything they do that to set up the interviews for this story, I interviewed all the principals, you know, so Kerr and Myers and Lacob and Draymond and KD and Steph and everybody. To get those interviews with the Warriors, usually you're trying to get one, and you spin a story, report around someone, you do Steph, maybe get Steph for 35 minutes, and then you report around them. Other features, you're looking for a lot more access. With the Warriors, you take what you can get. So in this case, it took about 2 months, in and out, practice, games, after games, sometimes halftime, to get all the principals. So that was, to me, the biggest challenge was the access. Mm-hmm. And the Warriors are as good as it gets in pro sports. Ryan Ritter is amazing. But even he, you know, I probably went to practice four times where I was supposed to get green and didn't get green. And then eventually we had it set, interestingly enough, for the Tuesday morning after the Clippers game.
Ah.
Yes. Yeah, that
excellent.
Worked out
I was going to get to that, but keep going.
And then I got a text, perhaps a disingenuous text, from Raymond saying that Draymond had forgotten that he had an appointment with his son to do something that day. So maybe we'd have to reschedule that interview.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So since you mentioned it, in the middle of your reporting, we have the first significant event, negative event in the Golden State Warrior era, a public battle on the court between Kevin Durant and Draymond Green that spilled over into the locker room that led to a lot of stories about this team in a negative light that we haven't seen in a while. How did that impact your reporting of the story?
And it changed the story entirely. At that point, most of the story was written, and it was a very difficult one to write because so much has been produced about the Warriors. We know this story. I've written a lot about the Warriors myself, and so you don't want to double back on themes you've already hit. So it was very difficult, and I ended up going with the concept, this is before the altercation between, or the incident between Green and Durant, the idea of, we all thought the Warriors, it looked easy. There was this perception that had grown, you know, they were ruining basketball, they were breaking the game, and they get DeMarcus, and there was this perception that it was just easy for them. But having seen enough of the inner workings there, I knew, well, that's part of the genius of the team is that they've made it look easy. But there are all these little flare-ups that whether it's Bob Myers or Kerr or Curry, whoever it is, has been putting down, and then we don't hear about them outside. There's all these, you know, forks in the path where had they gone one way, could have destabilized the organization. So I'd focused my reporting on that concept, and I was going to talk about the Warriors were always making small sacrifices, and these small sacrifices and these small adjustments were leading to the greater sustained excellence. And then, you know, this situation happens, and it was an example of when it did get passed, when the fire wasn't put out, and it made the story in some ways far more interesting because now you get to see it in action. Oh, here we see. Well, now it's gone past where it has been in the last 4 years. How do they react? How does Kerr react? How does Green react? How does Durant react? How does the organization react? And it's playing out in real time, but it also meant that the story had to be done about a week and a half ago for the most part. I knew it was going to be in limbo as it came out. And we won't have an answer until really, you know, do they win the finals, A? B, does Durant resign? And those will be the two markers of the success of this season.
Had you done a Sportsman of the Year story before?
I had not.
But you've written some long pieces in the past. I mean, is it the way as you're talking here, it feels like it's different that you go into a story like this about a team or a person that we're honoring for excellence, looking for those fissures. Does that feel different to you than another story?
It did, and I gotta say, I was a little uncomfortable with the concept of writing an honorific story to begin with. I understand it's part of a, you know, you really can't turn down the Sportsman assignment, but I didn't necessarily like that. You know, it's just so, it's, stories are more interesting when there is conflict, when there are shades of gray. That's what makes any narrative go. And just to honor, generally, those stories, I mean, you have to be really talented to make them interesting. Or some deep dive, it was a person, you can do a deep dive on backstory, on the humanity of it. But it's an organization, so it's harder to do that. But when this presented itself, it made it far more interesting to me. And I knew it wouldn't end up being necessarily an honorific story. It would have honorific elements. But I had to be, you know, relatively transparent about the challenges they're facing.
Mm-hmm. What did you were on this story for, you know, several months. Tell me something that you learned about this team that maybe you didn't know going into the story.
I guess it was the depth of each of the contributions. I hadn't necessarily recognized that, and the mutual respect the players have. Here's an example: Andre Iguodala is a very bright guy. And he's not always forthcoming with the media, but with his teammates, you know, they all love him, they rely on him. He was explaining to me, you know, you bring up anyone on the Warriors to Iguodala, he's going to have an interesting perspective. And he mentioned Klay Thompson. He said one of the most, the deepest conversations he's had with anyone on the Warriors was with Klay Thompson. And he didn't tell me the topic, he wanted to keep that between them, but he said it was one of those moments where he then realized, okay, you know, maybe I've underestimated this guy. But it was such a thoughtful analysis of it. The same way he looks at Draymond, and this is in the story, but he talked about before this incident, actually, he spoke about the idea that, you know, he thinks that sometimes when people on the outside dislike Green and say he's over the top and, you know, are out for him, he thinks, well, maybe sometimes that's almost a jealousy because they have things inside of them that they don't let out. And they see Draymond able to let that out. Now, is it always positive? No, obviously. But he's letting it out and he's working through it. And Iguodala said, look, that's something I learned from him and I try to apply to myself now. And so that, I guess it was like the depth, the thoughtfulness. I mean, Durant's incredibly thoughtful. Mm-hmm. Curry, thoughtful in his own way, very much he's focused on finding like an even-keeled approach to life. There's a level of, obviously, Kerr and Myers, of self-awareness on that team that you don't always find in sports.
What did you observe about the relationship between Durant and the rest of the team? I mean, these were a bunch of guys that were a 73-win bunch that had won a championship prior. Kevin Durant comes in, they win two on their way potentially to win three, but it always feels like it's them and then it's him coming in. What did you observe about that?
I think that's entirely right. When I spoke to him, it was a few days before, a week before the incident, and even then he used the phrase a partnership. He saw this as a partnership, and he referred to the Warriors as they. So it was Durant, and they were doing this, and they needed this. It wasn't we. He doesn't speak in we's. I think everyone understands that, and I think everyone's probably okay with that to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. He's never going to be part of that. He can't be part of that Warriors core. Someone else could come in. Livingston can come in, for example, and fits right into that core. He's got a certain ethos. Durant, it's not going to work. He's too good. and his style of play, he's forced his way to mesh it in, but it doesn't naturally mesh.
Mm-hmm. How does, you know, a guy like Draymond there, who is clearly the soul, let's call him, of that team, the heart of that team. But, you know, from my own experiences, I know that his antics grate on some people on that team. You know, I mean, where does his relationship stand with the rest of his teammates?
Draymond,
yeah.
Yeah. I think it remains great. They all, you know, the way Steph described it to me was you're not expecting it at first. And then it's a little overwhelming. And he said he picked someone new, and for a week in practice, he's just going after him and going after him. He's like, in the moment, you don't like it. You never like it. You're never going to like it. But if you get a big picture perspective, you start to realize the phrase that Steph used was he keeps people comfortably uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So he maintains an edge for the team, and he takes that role on, and he provides so much value to the team, both on the court and the locker room. There was an example where what was it, game 5 in Houston last year? I don't think this ended up with the story, but they came in after that game. They lost in Houston. They were going to have to win 2 in a row and come back to Houston. You know, obviously, Iguodala was out. It was a tough position to be in. And Eric Hausen told me that Draymond Green came in the locker room, and the first thing, can we swear on this podcast?
Sure, man.
Yeah. Came in the locker room, the first thing he shouted, he's like, We're coming back here, and we are winning this shit, and that's what's going to happen. It was an immediate tone setting. There was no second guessing. There was no doubting. There was no pointing of fingers. It was just come in, confidence. We're going to get this shit done. That is so valuable. Anyone who's played pickup hoops, and I know you play pickup hoops. Yes.
I think you're in 7 leagues right now.
Yes.
You're the only guy that can write a story like this and still not miss one of your pickup basketball games.
The value of those players, both on the court glue guy, but also that glue guy who comes in the huddle, like, let's get our head straight. Like, that is huge. We all know the value of that guy. Mm-hmm. And so I think his teammates totally recognize that. And the organization recognizes that. It's just, if there's one person, you know, it'd be Curry and Durant are the two that they might say, okay, that's a tough choice for us.
I believe in our circles, we call that the Bobby Clay of the – of yes. the franchise there.
Bobby Clay, one of the senior editors, ageless senior editor. When we were in our 20s, Mannix and Sean Gregory and some others playing on the SI Hoops team, he must have been 50?
Had to be.
Close, just out there pulling down every rebound, dominating. A lot of fire in his soul. A
lot of fire, and then you had Sean Gregory, who led our SI Hoops team in technical fouls year after year.
Yes.
That Princeton attitude, you yes. can't shake that out of him. Steve Kerr, you know, when you have a coach that has all this talent around him, sometimes people question the acumen of the coach if you could just plug somebody else in there. And it's interesting because if you go back many years ago, before Steve Kerr got that job, Stan Van Gundy was in the mix for that job. What's Steve Kerr's contribution to that? What is your take on Steve Kerr? And is it as simple as if a Van Gundy coached that team, if a Doc Rivers coached that team, if Coach X coached that team, they'd still have the same success?
It'd be really interesting to see. I think you would have, the way it's set up now, the team could run itself for the most part. You know, you could probably say, Iguodala. Let's put Iguodala in charge. You know, coach out the rest of this season. I'd be really curious to see what the record would be. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd have some issues.
Well, they kind of did that, right? Luke Walton taking over a
yep.
couple of years ago.
Yep. That's because of the foundation that's been built. So could a coach come in now and do it? Yes. And then the question would be, how long could they sustain it? How long till you hit the bump that then they go a different route and everything they built. But Steve's value has been in what he built and the depth of it. The pillars, the foundations of these are really strong, and his superpower is his emotional intelligence, his ability to relate to people and to communicate. That's really rare. I mean, Bob Myers has it too. So if you've got your two biggest figures in the organization have extremely high EQ, you're in great shape. And I mean, that's often the GM and the coach are at odds to a certain extent. You know, Myers and Kerr, tight. That's hard. You know, the way Bob described in this article was that's a relationship that's built to fail. And so they work on it. You know, it's like a marriage. They're working on it. And they're making sure they're not blaming each other. That's their mutual goal. And then always having each other's back. Steve said there'd be times when, you know, a player gets frustrated with Steve and it'll come to Bob. And he knows Bob's always going to back him up. And what Bob said, he said, what I tell the players is, look, you know, is Steve potentially wrong about some things? Of course. Do you want a different coach? Is he not easy to talk to? You know, is he making 80% of the right decisions? You know, what do you think? And that approach, so he will both listen to the player and then have his coach's back. So you have that authority there all the time. That's huge. So part of it's got to be Myers. So could Steve Kerr do this with a GM who is different? Probably, but it'd be different. You know, could he do it without an owner who, I mean, Joe Lacob, no matter what you think of him as personality-wise, has just been rock solid in supporting everything these guys do. Makes great hires, delegates well, goes in the luxury tax. So really, you know, part of this story was everyone saying, look, there is no one thing. It's not this, it's not this, it's not this. It's the sum of all these things.
I would think Steve's influence is most important with Draymond on that team. Like, I would imagine there are probably half the coach in the league that wouldn't be able to handle Draymond quite as well as Steve Kerr.
I agree with that, yeah, entirely. And that's been built over, as we know, years. And one, I think the one thing that really helped was that Steve went back at him. You know, that locker room situation, they were yelling at each other. You know, almost came
2016 Oklahoma City. Yeah, right.
almost came to a fight, and Steve was going back at him. But then the next step is the crucial one: is that both those guys can reflect on it. You know, Steve, what he does is he writes letters. So he wrote a letter to, you know, thought it out, wrote like 2-page letter to Draymond. Draymond apparently read just the first sentence, which said "I love you," and he threw away the rest because that was enough for him. But the ability to then reflect and move forward after the altercation, the conflict leads to growth. It's all these, you know, these sort of you know, aphorisms you hear in leadership circles. Steve actually does all these things, and Draymond also cares about it. He thinks about leadership a lot, and that's, you know, he sat in on the draft this year, sat in the whole draft with the team. He really wants to understand this. So that's, you know, you got a coach who's going to value that player the way he is, and then you have a player who's going to understand that the coach is – it's good for him.
You know, we brought up the incident in Oklahoma City. What did you make of the fact that that incident didn't yield any type of suspension for Draymond Green, whereas the Kevin Durant incident rose to a level? We don't know exactly what went on in the locker room between Durant and Draymond, but the fact that we do know that Steve Kerr and Draymond had to be separated, basically, in the Oklahoma City locker room, it was interesting that one was suspension worthy, the other was not.
Yeah. And I, you know, flip it, it might have been the same. You know, I think it's the, okay, you get a mulligan. And then the second time, there's, you know, other circumstances. You know, this was during the game. Overtime hadn't been played yet, number one. Number two, it became personal very quickly with Durant. That's different. And, you know, number three, it was with a fellow player, not with a coach. Coaches and players sort of go at it all the time. So there's a lot of elements, but I also think, like, now you had to take enough of a hard line to show the other players, you know, even if this is like, even if you knew Green would be fine, you can't have this precedent, especially with DeMarcus Cousins waiting in the wings here, of saying, okay, you can get away with this shit. Like, that's, I think that was the reason. I know they were, I don't know if they were worried about it. I would have been worried if I were them, the Warriors, about how it looked publicly. And I know there was discussion about this because it looks like they're backing Durant. But my guess is, from what I know, it was more of a decision based on, we can't allow this to stand, because then 6 months from now, you talk about, they're always thinking big game, long game. That can come back to bite us if something else happens. Like, oh, we didn't suspend Green that time. Now a precedent has been set.
You know, there's a real argument to be made that this Warrior team can survive any amount of adversity because of its talent and still win a championship. But did you get the sense, being around the team, that Kevin Durant's free agency is any type of anchor around them, that it is an elephant in the room type of situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what generated, you know, the dispute with Draymond, obviously. But it's crazy. You look at all these times that they go awry. It's almost always when Steph is injured. And so, you know, once Steph comes back, that's anchors. There's something I talk about in the story, which was last year. They went 7-10 down the stretch, and it also coincided. There's some other injuries. David West was hurt, among others, but Steph was out. And things just got funky. It was a bad vibe around the team. In the final game of the year, nothing really at stake for them. They're locked in, but they played Utah and lost by 40. It was an ugly game, and Green was yelling, and he was questioning Durant in particular again. Not too dissimilar, but not too Durant to the bench. And so this had happened before, and once Steph comes back, the equilibrium comes back. So
why is that?
I mean, it is remarkable to watch him. Like, I'm sure fans see the clips and they think maybe he turns that on. Like, he shows up the arena and he does his little shot from the side and has his shimmy. And I could see in someone else that being grating, especially after a while, to watch a player. You'd be like, oh, is he showboating? But if you watch Steph's like that all the time. He's like that in practice every day. And so if you go, if you're around someone who always has positive energy and happens to be one of the best basketball players in history, that's a pretty good combination. And he doesn't make it about him. Like, Steph never makes it about himself. So that's, I mean, that's why Kerr knows exactly why. Like, I couldn't do any of this without Steph. Like, that is, it's, you know, having Duncan, it's having Jordan. Teammates want to win for Steph. That's, you know, those are so rare that you get a player like that as a foundational player.
You know, it's interesting to bring up Duncan because a lot of people have said that if Duncan were around when the Kawhi situation was happening in San Antonio, it wouldn't have happened that way because Duncan would have seized control of that locker room. Does Steph have that type of sway in that Warrior locker room? I mean, he obviously has the equity to have it, but yep. does he take on that type of persona?
Well, you know, everything I heard was he has been more vocal this year on purpose. You know, he had Bruce Frazier over, assistant coach Bruce Frazier, 3 days before the season. He'd never done this before. And just wanted to talk. Ended up spending 4 hours, you know, on and off, eating dinner, but talking a lot. And he was asking Bruce questions, you know, what's your messaging to the team this year? What are the long-term goals? He's trying to become a more active leader. He'd always led by example. One of the things that Bruce said, it was like a player learning to dribble, and they look down. And he's like, you know, at this point in his career, Steph's looking up. He's seen the broader thing. He's never going to come in and do the tirade or the rah-rah speech. That's not him. That's Green. That's why he got Green on the team. But he will, by his actions, he will sit on the bench when he's injured like he did in that Texas trip and cheer like hell when something goes right and be there. And that's enough. You know, I think Frazier said, you know when he's not there. And he's like, I don't know what that is, but that's really valuable.
Is there a broader kind of fundamental takeaway from being around the Warriors in terms of how you build a team like that? Now, obviously, you have to have enormous success in the draft. I mean, Steph Curry was the third point guard drafted in the top 10 when he was selected. Klay Thompson slipped. Draymond Green was a second round pick. So obviously, you've got to have success in those areas. But for how they view team building, is there anything that's kind of a broader takeaway from that?
It's the idea that you can't focus on the things that seem important and not focus on the things that seem unimportant. That's what I've noticed, is this idea that you don't just go get the stars, right? You don't just say, okay, well, if we get a really good coach and three good players, we're set. You know, then we sort of, we'll do the other stuff well enough. The Warriors, their approach has been, ever since Lacob hired them, you know, I want Rick Welts because he's the best. You know, I want Jerry West to come in and launch us off the ground. He likes to hire people on the rise, for the most part. You know, Bob Myers on the rise, et cetera, Steve Kerr on the rise. But never saying, okay, that's good enough. So Mark Jackson took that team to a lot of wins, a playoff berth, broke the drought. And for a number of reasons, but one of them being, like, they needed to find someone that aligned with their principles and that it could take it to the next level. So never being satisfied. And that's, it's, you know, it sounds sort of hokey, but it's true. So if you watch their practices, you know, one of the hardest things is to be a reserve on the Warriors because the starters rest so much. So you're not necessarily getting reps. But those guys stay afterwards, and they're working on it. And, I mean, imagine being Kevon Looney. You could start on a lot of teams. There have been a lot of Warriors like that over the years. It's a great gig. You know, I'm sure he's not going to complain about it. But it's really hard to stand out for any of those players and for the Warriors to do things to make them feel valued. I'll give you one example. The schedule didn't work out this way, but when I saw Kerr last summer, he talked about the idea, he was hoping to have larger breaks between games. He's like, if we have like 3 days off, I'm going to tell all the stars, just go to Aruba, I don't care. Just go somewhere, do whatever you want to do. Chill out, you know, because you guys are going to need it. It's a long season. And then he would practice with just the reserves for 3 days. And then that when they came back, the starters would only play half the game. And the reserves get a chance to be the A team for half. Like, that's really big picture thinking. That kind of stuff is, you know, a lot of teams just, okay, we got stars, let's maximize. That was Mark Jackson's approach. Let's maximize Steph Curry. You know, and maybe I'm not paying attention to the Kevon Looneys.
The big question surrounding this team is maybe not will they win this year, because as we speak, they're, again, prohibitive favorites to win. But is this the last? You know, being around them, did you get any sense that you were watching the final chapter of this kind of Warrior dynasty?
I don't think it's the final chapter. So I, the sense I get is at this point, right now, you know, early December, most people assume Durant is more likely to leave than stay. There's reasons why he might stay, but, you know, I think it's whatever it might be, 70-30, 60-40. The team can sustain without him. The way this front office has thought, they have been working on plan Bs, and they will continue to work on plan Bs for a while. And the plan B might be pretty darn good. You know, they've certainly been interested in Anthony Davis for years now. And they will have...
Anthony Davis is only going to Boston, remember, that's it. He's only going to the yes. Celtics. That's the narrative, right? I'm just going to wait for people on Twitter to hear that and
there you go.
Come back. Yeah. Continue, sorry.
But yeah, and I think it will sustain because of all the... Now, let's say if you took out two of the pegs, let's say you took out Kerr and Green. I don't know. If you took out Curry, that's a pretty big peg, but probably, you know, it depends on who you got in there. Maybe you do it. But so you can take out Durant and the team will survive. Can you take out Durant, Thompson, Iguodala? I don't know. That's tough. Each of those guys is so integral in their own way. I mean, Iguodala is getting older. His value often comes less in game to game and what else he brings. But Clay would be really tough to replace.
Do you think that the outcome of this season will have any influence on Kevin Durant? I mean, the argument for Durant staying is you win three in a row, why would you walk? I mean, LeBron has even said, and I'm going to paraphrase a little bit here, that if they had won, you know, their last championship, Miami, might have been tough for him to leave a potential 3 or 4, 5, 6 type of situation. Yeah. Do you think with Durant that has any or will have any impact?
Yeah, I can't imagine. I can't certainly can't say that I understand Durant's thinking. I can just go off of what I've heard and the conversation we had. He's very much focused on two things. One, focusing just on basketball. He said, I realized it's enough for me. It didn't used to be. I thought I had to go travel the world and go out to the nightclubs, all these things I was supposed to do. But I realized I don't really want to do those things, you know, just basketball. And then within that, he wants to get better and keep achieving new things. So to me, that sounds like someone who just wants to find another challenge. And it's not necessarily that the Warriors aren't a great opportunity. He doesn't like the Warriors. It might just be what he wants to prove these things. Look, I want to prove this. I want to prove that. I want to find out how good I can be. Can I be the leader? Can I be, you know, maybe that's it. I don't know. You know, I think he's probably less inclined. Some players really value the historical stuff. I think Kobe for sure did, where the idea of, okay, I could win 4 in a row, you know, or I could be part of this history-making thing. I'm not sure that's what drives Kevin.
I think the tougher question for Golden State, honestly, is, you know, Durant can make his own decision. He'll do what he wants. But you have Draymond, 2020, hitting free agency, you know, right around 30 years old, looking for a max-level contract. It's a difficult contract to hand out for a player that I'm not sure, Chris, that he ages all that well. His perimeter game has already started to slide, never was great to begin with. He's a high-energy guy, an undersized guy. That would be, you know, if you're Golden State and you're talking about rebooting this whole thing, if Durant decides to walk, that might be another area you look at.
Yeah, that's going to be really difficult. And you're going to have all that equity that he brings. And there's going to be a sense of loyalty from the franchise, I imagine.
Hardest thing to do, though, is be proactive.
Right.
To see something potentially coming and be bold to do it. I mean, I bring up Boston, but they did it, you know, with their trend. Not to say you get the same haul for Draymond Green, but... You know, what Boston got for Pierce and Garnett and even Rondo has enabled them to be what they are right now.
And you're going to have to take a big hit. I remember when the 49ers, to make a Bay Area analogy, when the 49ers, you know, let Joe Montana go. And there was a huge blowback. And Montana had a good season with the Chiefs. But Steve Young then won them all those Super Bowls. That'll be a difficult decision for the Warriors. The thing with Green is, so can he do the Jason Kidd thing and become a reliable enough, like get you up to like 35% on threes? If he does that, that extends his career. You know, probably not a max level player, but if Draymond is 35, he's such a competitor. You look at guys like PJ Tucker, they're still really valuable, but he's going to have to be able to knock down that three-pointer.
What's your take on Clay before we finish here? Because another guy that's a free agent, who nobody really expects to go. And I base this somewhat on like a couple of conversations I've had with him over the years, public comments he says where he constantly says, I just like to win. And I think everyone's expecting him to want to be this alpha somewhere else or want to ply his craft somewhere else, maybe alongside LeBron or wherever with the Lakers. But he never strikes me as that type of guy. Do you think he's hiding something or do you think that's genuine?
I think he's so rare in sports, right? There's only one. It's great because, you know, Kerr calls him, he's not low maintenance, he's no maintenance. Myers used the analogy of a band and he's like, you know, Clay Thompson's the bassist who never needs to sing. He's just in the background playing the bass line. You know, Green's the drummer, of course. And then you got Curry and Durant are the two lead singers. Who's going to get to sing this time? But Clay's just like that. I mean, there are fans out there where their favorite player is Clay Thompson, because he's so good defensively. He's so fun to watch. He's got this crazy shooting confidence, and he's actually doing this to play basketball. So it's like, why would I leave there? I don't want change. I don't want drama. There's no ego gratification required. It's funny, a lot of players are excited to do interviews, especially when they're not the alpha. Clay, he's like, he'll grudgingly do them, but like he won't do it in the offseason. Like, he's not doing it. You know, it's sort of like people will push him. You should become a bigger brand. I don't want to be a brand. I want to go play with my bulldog at Point Isabel and hang out, right?
So you didn't – when the incident happened with Draymond and KD, you didn't say, shit, I'm screwed. You said something else?
Actually, Clay, this is what I heard from players. Clay stood up in the locker room and said something. The three people that spoke first was Steve Kerr, then Iguodala, and then Clay. And that's probably not what people expected to hear. But he's a ballast in there, I think, a little bit. And my guess is, you know, if they keep Green and Curry, Clay is probably fine. I don't know. I don't think he'll start worrying if Durant goes.
Well, Chris, great story. It's in the magazine this week. If you want more of the Sports Person of the Year, we've got our award show. That's going to be Thursday, 12:13 at 9 Eastern time. It's going to be on NBC Sports Network. We are here for the taping of it right now. Are you going to be like a minor celebrity at this thing tonight? Yeah, Warriors going to like you. Right. Bob Myers going to give you a big hug.
Yeah.
Best friends forever. Yeah. Thunder buddies for life.
There you go.
Something like that. Yes. Chris, thanks for joining, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
That's it for this week's episode. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.